From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Opioids are a big problem for Georgia.
We're seeing more people using prescription drugs, abusing prescription drugs. Those are easy to get, and so we're seeing a growth in that over the past couple of years.
2015 saw 549 reported overdoses, and those numbers are going up. As always, we'd love to get your opinion. Has this epidemic touched your life? What do you think can be done about it? Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message, or post to social media. We might feature your comments on the show. If I told you all the awards he's won and movies and TV shows he's made and books that he's written, we would have no time left to talk to Henry Winkler. Most people know him as the Fonz. That's the slick teenage greaser he played on TV's Happy Days.
Could you move that up a little bit? Over to the left.
Winkler comes to Georgia this week for the Decatur Book Festival. He's the co-creator of a popular children's book series that centers on Hank Zipser, a young boy with learning difficulties. And that's something Henry knows a lot about.
I was intimidated by reading. My eyes couldn't follow the type print on the page. So let's take A Tale of Two Cities. Let's take Ivanhoe. I couldn't read it. I dripped water on the pages. I let it dry. It crinkled up. And when I carried the book, it looked like I was abusing it. I read it so hard and never read a word.
So was it different for you then? Was it easier to read a script?
No, it wasn't. I was embarrassed for years because we did Happy Days for 10 years. Arrested Development for 3 years. You would sit around the table. You would read the script out loud, and I would stumble over every word, which not only made me feel bad, but then I would ruin the timing for my fellow actor.
So what was it like for you when you were actually diagnosed, when somebody explained to you why?
Nobody explained to me why. They explained to me about my stepson, Jed, who was in the third grade, and we had him tested, and everything that they said about him was true about me. And that's how I realized, oh my goodness, I've got something with a name. I'm not actually stupid. I'm not actually lazy. I'm not actually, trying to be a troublemaker.
And since then, you've said you're an avid reader. You can't stop.
Well, I read slowly, but I love reading people like Daniel Silva, Lee Child.
Thrillers.
I'm slogging my way through Hamilton.
The biography. So then tell me about how do you go about creating these books that you know a young child who might also be dyslexic or have some other kind of reading impediment? How do you go about knowing how to write a book that will help them?
Okay. They're not for help. They are to make the child laugh. That is the most important. And then they happen to be about my life. And we found, my partner Lynn Oliver and I have found, we're writing now the 12th novel in this series, the last Hank Zipser ever.
Why is it the last?
Well, because, it's now, I think it'll be 29 novels, and that's, we've come to the end, and we're going to start a new project, I think. But be that as it may, what we found is that if I write the truth about the emotionality of what it was like being eight and what it was like not being able to keep up with everybody and looking around and saying, I want to read, I want to do math, I want to spell, and just having a brain that wouldn't cooperate. If you write the truth, kids write you back and they say, how did you know me so well? And when you write the humor and you make them laugh, all of a sudden they like reading and they write back and they say, my funny bone fell out of my body that I laughed so hard. And then you've got parents who write us and say, I walked by my child's room, I heard them laughing, I opened the door, and they're reading their first book they wouldn't read before.
Yeah, I want to read you this review I found on Amazon, and it says, quote, my 10-year-old son will only review this as so-so, but he lies. I said I would read these to him. By the end of two pages, he wanted to read every other page, and he wanted to read by himself. He is autistic. He still got the jokes and told me he likes stories about kids that are his kind of normal, you know, not magic or powerful, and they don't really get adults. Honestly, I wanted to see if Fonzie could tell a good story, but I'm hooked, and my son is not only reading without a fight, but with anticipation. How common is a story like that for you?
Well, first of all, let me just soak that in. I have not read that before, and that is so touching, I don't know what to do with myself. And that encapsulates the reaction that we get from the child, from teachers, from the parent, and then kids who don't have a problem learning read our books because they're funny, and they go, oh, that's why Max is like that. That's why Tiffany has that problem.
I'm speaking with actor, producer, and children's book author Henry Winkler. He's in Georgia for the Decatur Book Festival. And I want to play a clip. You actually play Mr. Rock, one of your teachers, in the TV version of this series.
Yes, can I just say this?
Sure.
We could not sell Hank Zipser on television for anything. And I finally sold it to the BBC, where it was a hit for the last 3 years, in the top 10. And it's finally coming to America.
Wow. Congratulations. When's that happening?
I can't say because there's going to be a big announcement. I'm just thrilled.
Well, let's hear a little bit of you playing Mr. Rock. In this clip, you're showing Hank how to play softball.
Okay. Hank, I am so sorry. You've got to take off your socks.
I play much better with them on.
I'm sure you do. We are not going to make fun of your toes. Unless, of course, they're hairy. At which time it's open season. Come on, as quickly as you can. People are waiting.
Okay, Hank. Easy does it. I need to hide these hideous, girly sparkles.
Okay, so is it true that the teachers, Miss Adolph and Mr. Rock, were actually based on teachers you had?
They were. Miss Adolph truly, I think, first of all, was related. And second of all, the worst teacher on the planet. Mr. Rock was the man who said to me, Winkler, if you ever do get out of high school, you're going to be great. And I held on to that one sentence until like last Wednesday.
I'm tempted to ask what happened last Wednesday, but I assume you're speaking metaphorically.
I want
to play another comment, and this is about your acting. This is Gary Marshall, and he's talking about your portrayal of Fonzie.
I'm watching the show. I like the tough guy, played wonderfully by Henry Winkler. He wasn't at all like Fonzie Henry Winkler, but he could act it. And he just made guttural sounds and had ho-ho and hey, and a lot of them Henry made up himself, whoa-ing and hey-ing.
So how different is the job of author, especially children's book author, from the job of actor?
Do you know what? That's an interesting question. As a matter of fact, I don't know that I've ever been asked that before. So let's look at that. Okay, so here are the similarities. You're using your imagination. As an actor, I read what the author has written about the character, what people say about the character, and how I feel as I am talking the lines to another human being. And then you put that all together, and then you put that through who you are, and you bring yourself. As an author, I'm walking around Lynn's office, or I'm sitting in the rocking chair on the other side of her desk, and I am talking, and I'm using my imagination and my instinct, and I just let it flow. And out of that comes the book. Lynn, we participate completely intertwined as authors. I mean, it is not, these stories are not as told to. I talk, she types, I wait. She reads it back to me, and then we argue over every word.
I find it interesting that your fellow actors have often described you as a collaborative actor, somebody who likes to be part of a troupe, I guess.
Yes, that is true.
And you've also chosen, as an author, to be a collaborator as well.
I would not be able to write these books on my own. I mean, I am so lucky that I found Lynn. Otherwise, these books would never have gotten started. In the beginning, I was convinced that there was no way I could write. And so what I tell every child that I meet, every human being that I meet, you don't know what is lying inside you waiting to come out. And all you have to do is put one foot in front of the other and try.
How difficult will it be for you to say goodbye to Hank and Cheerio and the iguana and all the other characters in the book?
It will be difficult to say goodbye, but it is also time to let it go. And I, outside of my children and my grandchildren and my Labradoodle, I don't know that I am prouder of anything I've accomplished in my life.
So when can we expect the first book in whatever might be the new series?
The new series, we've just finished the Bible, which means we have written the outline to give you the sense of what the three novels will be, and we're sending them into the publisher. And then once we get the go-ahead, after we finish the 12th Here's Hank, you know, the last line, I will tell you, I came up with the last line of the 12th Here's Hank, and he accomplishes something that he didn't think he could do. He's in his bed. He says, you know, he knows that he cannot keep up with the other students. He always feels badly about that. And he said, you know, Mom, I finally realized I can be somebody.
It has been a real pleasure.
Can I just say this?
Sure.
I cannot wait to meet you. I'm not kidding. To get up to come to Decatur. And you do that only to meet you, whoever you are and whoever shows up.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's true.
Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday. That was actor and children's book author Henry Winkler. He's in Georgia for the Decatur Book Festival. You can see him at 5 p.m. Friday at Decatur High School's Performing Arts Center. Just ahead, a look into Georgia's opioid epidemic. First, though, author and hip-hop scholar Regina Bradley joins us. This is On Second Thought. These happy days are yours and mine. These happy days are yours and my happy days. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The civil rights movement in the South is well documented, but one author says what happened next could use more explanation. Regina Bradley is author of Boondock Collage, New Stories from the Contemporary Black South. The book offers 12 short stories chronicling Southern life in the post-civil rights era. Regina joined us this past June.
Hi, Celeste. How are you?
It's good to have you, and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you.
Can we start with the dedication? Half the dedication says, "For my blood, chosen, and forgotten kinfolks, I'm writing myself back to you."
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, it's a little bit of everything. So I initially started this project to reclaim my creative voice, because graduate school just takes all creativity out of you. And so I was really thinking about just those stories that I heard growing up, those stories that I wanted to tell, and this idea that, you know, in Albany and pretty much across the, you know, the Black South, this idea of community is important. So your kinfolks, so the people that I haven't talked to in a while, the people that I wanted to reconnect with, I think that writing these stories was a way to do that.
You're talking in this book through all these stories, which are lyrical. They struck me as very Southern because they're
Thank
so
you.
Lyrical.
And, I try.
And so much bigger than your average story, right? I mean, everything in the South is bigger. The fish is always bigger. The tree is always taller. But you're talking about growing pains here. And you're talking about growing pains, not of yourself, not just yourself, but even people in your book who are elderly, and how they grew past the civil rights era. Why use stories to talk about that instead of just a nonfiction academic book?
That's boring. I just find that storytelling is a way to bring various groups together, and I think it was important for me to acknowledge through this project that I'm not at all dismissing the older generations in the South, but I do want to recognize and make room for the fact that there are new voices and new narratives and new experiences that are not necessarily restricted, but are especially adapt to the post-civil rights South. And the other part of it too is, you know, I was raised by my grandparents, so it was really important for me to recognize the fact that they also moved on with me past the civil rights movement. It just might be in a different perspective, so I wanted to include that in the stories.
So you there's this dichotomy, and you have talked about this before, between trying to honor those who have gone before you and
right.
yet move on.
Yes.
And that is sometimes an uneasy alliance. We have seen cases in which lions of the civil rights movement have spoken very angrily about new generations and how they protest and how they define themselves as Black Americans or African Americans. Did you find a new understanding of that through the process of writing this book?
A little bit. My grandma is super nervous about this book. She said that I used some language that she said, well, one, she said it wasn't ladylike, but two, she was also concerned about reception because of that exact fact, right?
This idea. This is Nana Boo that you refer to.
Nana Boo.
Nana Boo and Pawpaw.
Yeah. Yeah, Nana Boo and Pawpaw. Just trying to find a way to connect these experiences together, and being able to include those tensions in the book is particularly important. So I think one of the stories that really does that for me is Between the Hedges, which kind of talks about this grandfather and his grandson. He got accepted to UGA, and then the grandfather has a flashback about how he wanted to go to UGA, but something happened, and that's why he didn't go. So,
No spoilers. All right, let's talk a little bit about the connections to hip hop. How does hip hop fit into this narrative of growing up and creating a new post-civil rights Black Southern narrative?
Yeah, so if folks are looking for like a book of freestyles, you know, it didn't make the cut this time. So it's bigger than just thinking about hip hop culture in terms of lyricism. One of the things that I really love about Southern hip hop is that we pull from everyday experiences. So when I say the hip hop South, not only am I talking about like chronologically, which is, you know, after 1968, but also the different aesthetics that impact that. So the ideas of community, the ideas of sound, the ideas of improv and dialogue and joking around, all of these things that are very much part of the Southern hip hop landscape, I try to give some kind of justice to in the book project. So yeah, so Boondock Collage is actually a shout out to Film Ops. When they first started, that was their name, Boondock and Collage. But I wanted to take it a step further in terms of thinking about the idea that there are multiple narratives, multiple experiences of what it means to be Southern. So that's where the collage part comes in. And, you know, also the idea of the Boondocks. One, it says it's nowhere, but also like if you're in the South and in the country, like, oh, you live in the boondocks. So just putting those two together.
Did you just call Albany the boondocks?
I did. I could do that. I'm from there.
All right. Let's revisit another pretty important event that you reference in the book, and that's Hurricane Katrina. Yeah. And you describe it as a sort of pivotal point. So here's a little flavor of that. In 2015, we spoke with Audrey Boyd. She's 95 years old. It was at the time. Now in Marietta, relocated there from New Orleans after the hurricane.
And we had to get out of that boat and walked all the miles. I think it was 24. And a fella said to me, a youngster, he said, Grandma, you'll make it. It makes me think at the age I am, you see, that man above is with me.
Why do you describe Hurricane Katrina as so pivotal in terms of civil rights?
Well, Hurricane Katrina is a turning point for what we think the Southern is, especially Southern Black folks. I mean, it physically reshaped the Southern region, culturally reshaped the Southern region because of folks that were displaced, not refugees, displaced, because they're, you know, citizens. That always kind of irked me. But being able to kind of see how the physical, the cultural re-renderings of what it means to be Southern, because these folks have been removed from their particular South and being introduced to these other forms of South. So Houston, Atlanta, further west, further northeast. And it just really did things to kind of reshape and reimagine what that contemporary Southernness means. And in terms of civil rights, I mean, aside from the fact that you have a lot of justified criticism about the way that the response to Hurricane Katrina was handled, and yet we're still feeling those after effects, those after ripples of the impact of that storm, is very much important and very much a part of the contemporary Southern conversation.
That was Regina Bradley. She's author of Boondock Collage, New Stories from the Contemporary Black South. In the wiregrass country of South Georgia, a plaque in the town of Quitman marks a hanging place. It's where, in August of 1864, four men were executed for plotting a slave rebellion. Over the next century, mob violence against African Americans erupted in Brooks County regularly. This is where our senior editor, Don Smith, was born and raised. He moved away in 1958. Don recently returned to his hometown to mark the anniversary of the Civil War hanging and talk with longtime residents about how they remember the county's history of racial violence. GPB's Emily Curitan reports.
This used to be...
The town Don Smith remembers has changed.
It used to be the pool hall. That's the general, the Hotel General Quitman.
One constant, though, is the stately courthouse in the center of Quitman, Georgia. A marker by the entrance honors the county's founders.
Created by act of the legislature December 11, 1858, is named for Preston Smith Brooks, zealous defender of states' rights.
Preston Brooks was a U.S. congressman, perhaps best known for severely beating Senator Charles Sumner because he spoke against slavery. Next to the sign bearing the Brooks name, an obelisk.
Our Confederate dead, erected by the Ladies Memorial Association, 1878. Looks like a headstone.
A chunk of granite is missing from the corner of the monument.
Somebody's taking a whack at that.
This is not the monument we're looking for. We're looking for a marker about four people who were hanged in front of the courthouse during the Civil War's final year. But we don't find it by the courthouse. It's not next to a gazebo on the lawn either.
You mean the one for the black, that's it over there. They wanted it over here, but they wouldn't let them put it over here, so they had to put it over there.
This is George Boston Rhines. We wait for a semi-truck loaded with pine logs to pass, and George leads us across the highway to a sign posted between the sidewalk and the curb. He pulls back a tree branch to read the text.
Civil War slave conspiracy. In August 1864, during the American Civil War, four men were executed in Brooks County, Georgia, for conspiring to plot a slave insurrection.
Over the next 70 years, mobs in Brooks County killed at least 24 people. That's more documented lynchings than in any other county in the United States during the same time period. At least 550 people were killed by mobs in Georgia between 1880 and 1930. That's all according to the Georgia Historical Society.
Right down the street, right down in there, there used to be a filling station right there. And that filling station, I can't think of the name of it, but this is the first time I had ever seen the Ku Klux Klan was right down the street, and when they marched down the street, I was a little child.
Rhines graduated in 1970 from Quitman's all-black high school. We get in his car and drive across town, where we pull up to a blue house and follow him inside to meet Owen Rice.
Not bad for a young man. Not bad. Not bad. Good to see you. Good to see you. Owen Rice. I never spelled it like you meant R-I-C-E, but mine is W-R-I-C-E. Okay. All right.
The TV in the corner shows images of white supremacists marching in Boston that day. President Obama's portrait is pressed against the glass door of a china cabinet. Rice settles into his recliner.
I spent 20 years in the military. I spent 19 years and 5 months with the railroad. And I've never been anywhere that I traded for Brooks County, because the people in Brooks County are loving people. People in Brooks County are friendly people. Now, that don't mean all of them is good.
Rice says the Confederate monument in town doesn't mean a whole lot to him, but another fixture on the courthouse lawn does.
Look here. That gazebo, that's for auction off black people just like you auction off hogs and cows.
When ordinary white person look at the Brooks County Courthouse, they don't see that auction block. That's what I see. I see the auction block. They can put it. You say gazebo. I don't call it gazebo. I call it the auction block. I know that what they did there.
We weren't able to verify exactly where slaves were auctioned in Brooks County, but historians at Valdosta State University told us it would not be unusual for those auctions to be held on the courthouse grounds. Rice says he doesn't dwell on symbols of the past.
Those things, they are behind, and I try to leave them behind because I'm looking toward the future.
We visit another longtime resident.
Yeah, don't get me started.
Jean Logan is a founding member of the Brooks County Historical Society and Museum. She graduated from an all-white high school in 1945.
I'm 89 years old.
Logan says she does not support moving Confederate monuments.
Moving it doesn't change anything. It happened. And that's just a part of our country, part of our heritage.
She says old newspapers are one of her favorite windows to the past.
In every issue, the editors have praised the virtues of Quitman and Brooks County, and have urged the citizens on to bigger and better things.
One of the most celebrated things in Brooks County, Georgia today is definitely high school football.
Go straight on in, there's a sofa right there, and we'll sit down on.
When we have football games here, black folks and white folks sit elbow to elbow.
That's Coach Maurice Freeman.
Born and raised here in Brooks County, actually, and I'm the football coach here and athletic director. Graduated from Brooks County High School in 1983.
The high school was integrated by then. I asked Freeman about the demographics of the football team now.
We are 90% African American. Yes, we are about 90% African American. We have a few white males and a couple of Hispanic males on the team.
Freeman says recent events have sparked conversations about race in the locker room.
Those have been tough discussions.
He says the relationship between his players and local police is often strained.
They're jittery around the police. They feel like they're targeted or watched a lot more than the white male.
And when a player was arrested recently,
next thing you know, there are quite a few people out there around saying, hey, you're unjustly stopping this young man. Somebody called me, coach, you better get down here. So it was like 10:30 at night. I got up and went down. But they just needed a cooler head. And let's just say I had a cooler head.
Freeman believes things have gotten better than since he was a kid.
Maybe I was 14, 15 years old, and that was, I liked a white female at that time. She was my next door neighbor. We stayed out in the country. She was the only girl out there, actually. I went to the store one day, and a group of white males just, that knew that I was kind of dating her, they just took off and decided to chase me and wanted to beat me up. There was just too many of them for me to think I was going to win it, so I took off running. Just some of the words that they called me were pretty tough. I kind of had a different look at my neighbors after being called all that.
He doesn't remember exactly who chased him, but it's possible he's coached their kids.
I've coached players and I've coached their sons. I, for one, don't think racism will ever go away.
We move on to our last stop that day in Quitman.
Well, I know Grandmother Smith is planted somewhere out here. So, my mother's parents.
The cemetery where most of Don's family is buried.
Mine. Mommy. The only problem with dredging up memories is sometime one creeps in and gets you that you weren't expecting to.
That piece was produced by GPB's Emily Curitan. To see pictures of her trip to Brooks County with our editor Don Smith, visit gpbnews.org. Just ahead, how to deal with a growing addiction to opioids. This is On Second Thought. On my way to you, oh. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. Tomorrow, we air a special documentary about opioid use, and we'd love you to join that conversation. Has the opioid epidemic impacted your life or the life of someone that you know and love? Call us and leave a message with your story at 404-500-9457, and be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Middle Georgia suffered a high number of drug overdoses last month. In less than a week, 19 people were hospitalized with similar symptoms. There were 32 reported cases and 3 fatalities in June alone. Last week saw another 7 overdose cases reported. Joining us last month was Chris Hendry, Chief Medical Officer of Navicent Health, Shannon Gordon, CEO of River Edge Behavioral Health Center in Macon, and Mark Lewis, who is both a writer and neuroscientist. So, Chris, what was the cause of these overdoses? And by that, I mean we have been suffering through an opioid addiction epidemic for a number of years. But why this particularly severe number of cases?
Well, it appears that there was a new compounded tablet that was being sold on the street as Percocet. And in reality, it looks like from the GBI analysis of the chemicals, it was actually a compound that was similar to fentanyl and another compound that's on the street known as pink. So neither of the drugs inside of the tablet that people were purchasing as Percocet were actually Percocet. And the drugs are extremely potent, which accounted for the number of overdoses we saw in such a short period of time.
Mark, what makes fentanyl so dangerous?
Well, as Chris said, it's very potent. It's a 2 milligram quantity is enough to kill somebody. And there's a whole lot of analogs of similar drugs, some of which are 10 or 100 times more powerful. And these drugs seem to be quite cheap to manufacture, so they're just popping out on the street all over the place, sometimes mixed with heroin, sometimes in pill form, and the buyers never know what they're getting.
Now, Shannon, we have had a lot of discussion nationwide about the overprescription of painkillers. But in many cases, and I think it looks like this case, these are things that people bought on the street. Is this something that you find is common?
Yes. At some point, people do move to the street to satisfy their desire for chemicals.
How? Give me an idea of that sort of common timeline of someone who becomes addicted and how they end up buying pills that may be dangerous on the street.
Well, every person is an individual, and so the timeline is not static. I've not known someone ever in my history of treatment to want to start and end up in addiction. People begin to manage pain, or they begin to see what it's like, and then the drug begins to take its hold.
So here's a comment from Bibb County Sheriff David Davis. He was speaking at a press conference just a few weeks back.
I would invite anyone who has a drug problem or who takes illegal drugs and is worried right now that they may face some legal repercussions, We're going to let that pass. We need to know who's putting this poison in the community right now.
Chris, how do you know when your use of painkillers is dangerous?
Well, like Shannon said, most of the time these people start off because they've got some type of pain they need to control, whether it's some post-operative pain or an injury or what have you. And it's insidious. It's not like one day you're taking your pain medication and the next you're addicted and are engaging in risky behaviors. But if you're starting to miss work, if you're buying, unable to get the drugs from your physician, you're looking at asking your friends, you're borrowing their drugs, or you're getting them on the street. And once you start engaging in those risky behaviors, you should be able to recognize that you're no longer in control of your life with regard to your pain control.
So we have, in 2015, opioids were involved in more than 33,000 deaths nationwide, and opioid overdoses have quadrupled since 1999. This is information from the Attorney General's offices of Georgia. 55 Georgia counties have overdose rates higher than the national average. Mark, do we have an idea of why we're seeing such a spike in these addictions and deaths at this point in our history?
Well, we have some ideas, but I think it's important to get on the table that very few people who take opioids for pain actually become heroin addicts, actually start using street drugs. The percentage given by NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, is 4%. So only 4% of people who actually take prescription opioids go on to use drugs for recreational purposes. And that's really important. It's like most people who dive start off swimming, but it isn't the case that everyone who swims ends up diving, right? So that's an important element. So I don't think the cause is actually in the drug. I don't think the drug takes hold of a person. I think that's kind of a magical sort of metaphor. Rather, I think it's the person's life, a sense of meaninglessness or emptiness, a sense of dislocation, loneliness, not knowing who you are or how to fit in with your community, with your friends, with your culture. I think those are really, really important factors.
Then let me take that to both Shannon and Chris as well, in terms of what's causing this spike in overdoses and why is what Mark's talking about. Why are those kind of distinctions important, Chris?
The spike in overdoses, in what I've read and doing some research on this, is the introduction of fentanyl and designer drug analogs similar to fentanyl into the marketplace. The drugs that typically we use to control pain medication are Percocet, Lortabs, these type things, and they have OxyContin and hydrocodone in them, which don't have near the potency. The introduction of black market fentanyl derivatives, to me, seems to have heralded the increased number of overdoses in the last 2 years. These are not drugs that were originally prescribed to patients for pain control. Fentanyl has been around since the 60s as an adjunct to anesthesia. We do use it in like spinal epidurals and certain pain control, but it's all under the supervision of a physician, typically in a hospital setting. Later it became, they put it on patches for pain control in patients with terminal disease such as cancer to control their pain. These drugs being introduced into the street have resulted in the increased number of overdoses that you see.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with River Edge Behavioral Health Center CEO Shannon Gordon, also Navicent Health Chief Medical Officer Chris Hendry, who you just heard, and neuroscientist Mark Lewis. This discussion we're having at this moment is a little bit problematic because it appears that law enforcement, at least, is focused on prescriptions. So we got this message from Attorney General Chris Carr of Georgia, who says from June 2016 to May of 2017, the total number of legal opioid doses prescribed to Georgia patients surpassed 541 million, and we are losing far too many citizens as a result of drug overdose doses. And then he pledges to work on behalf of the people of Georgia to stop this. But Shannon, where should attention be focused, on prescriptions or on street medication?
On prescription. In 2009, opioid prescriptions were the most abused drug by young adults, according to the National Institute of Drug Abuse. And so that's where I would put my focus.
Then let's take this to the broader subject here, which is how we treat opioid addiction or addiction in the medical community and as a society, because there is sometimes an argument, especially among policymakers, about whether to treat addiction, like drug addiction like this, as a moral failing, a weakness in your character, or as a disease. We went out and asked people here in Atlanta what they thought, and here's the first person.
My name is Howard Connolly. I live here in Atlanta, Grant Park area. I think it starts off as a moral and turns into a medical, because sometimes a person's environment, stress levels, things of that nature might turn them towards what they might deem as a way to relax and get away from it, and that creates the addiction. And then you have to treat an addiction through medical resources.
Mark, what do you make of this question?
Well, I don't see addiction as a disease, but I do see it as a very powerful habit that becomes deeply ingrained. I think we have to look at what's in the drug, what the drug is doing for the person. And opioids are being received by brain systems that are in charge of reducing stress, as Shannon said, but also reducing pain, reducing a sense of panic. So why are people going around feeling so stressed and so panicked and so alone that they might want to take large doses of opioids? And by the way, it's not correct to go after the prescription opioids per se, because it's, as Chris said, it's fentanyl. It's street fentanyl. It's killing people. And that's, you know, that's a whole different matter. But, you know, we have to ask deeper questions rather than just who should we go after, or whether it's a disease or not.
Well, but this, whether to treat it as a disease is a question that's going on in terms of where to put money. So let me put this to you, Shannon. Here's another comment from someone that we spoke to.
I'm Jasmine Brookings from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm going to say a moral problem. Simply because, you know, growing up in a black community, we go through more problems than the Caucasians go through. So, you know, we're more affected by the drug use.
Shannon, how much does this particular question affect our treatment of someone with an addiction?
I see the issue of it's being perceived as a moral issue as a tremendous barrier to seeking treatment because of the shame that's associated with addiction, so many do continue to see it as a moral failing. But people move into addiction when they use compulsively, when they experience cravings, when they continue to use despite negative consequences, and when they've developed physical tolerance that results in withdrawal when the chemical is stopped, and that is medical.
All right, so let's hear one more comment from someone here in Atlanta.
My name is David Traeger. I live up in Duluth, Georgia. I think it's a little bit of both. As far as medically, I think that there's something in your brain that just doesn't allow you to stop that addiction, you know. And then as far as like morally, you kind of know it's wrong. Like I smoke, and I know it's wrong, but it's just very difficult for me to stop.
So, Chris, is it fair to make the comparison between an addiction to painkillers to something like smoking or a more common addiction?
Yes, absolutely. The physical changes the body undergoes after their exposure to opioid drugs are, in some cases, the first dose can rewire how your nervous system works, which is why patients who detox off of heroin or other opioid-type medications that act on the opioid pain receptors, often this has to be done in a supervised situation. The patients can have confusion, seizures, nausea, vomiting, dehydration, hallucinations. These are signs of a physical removal of the chemical that they become dependent on, the same as nicotine.
So, Mark, where in this process, as somebody moves from being treated with painkillers, maybe post-surgical or something like that, and possibly down the road toward addiction, where's the best point for intervention?
Yeah, we're conflating two things here. One is physical dependency, chemical dependency, which is what Chris described. And the other is the psychological elements of addiction, which are much more serious. When people really get addicted to something, they often stop and stay off for a while and then come back to it a few months later, a few years later, and it's the continuing relapsing, which is a psychological issue, because by then the drug is nowhere. It's been out of your body for a very long time. These psychological changes have to do with habits of thinking, I need to take this to feel better. And that's the habit that needs to be changed. And I don't think we have the tools to change it from a medical perspective. Medicine is great for dealing with withdrawal symptoms and overdoses and stuff like that for the drugs that do become physically, that do create physical dependencies like opioids. But cocaine, for example, there's no physical dependency. Gambling is known to be an addiction, is defined as an addiction, but obviously there's no chemical dependency. So I don't think medicine is actually well equipped to deal with the psychological changes that need to happen for people to get better.
So Shannon, this is quite literally your business. What do you make of that?
I would concur with Mark that it is a biopsychosocial and physical phenomena that needs holistic approach.
You know, it's interesting that you brought up gambling. When you look at behavioral conditioning, random positive reinforcement is the strongest behavioral modification that you can do, and that's what you see with gambling and slot machines, because it's this random payout, and the reinforcement in your behavior is dramatic.
Well, then how does that work look in terms of treatment? How do you then treat that?
Well, most when you talk to heroin addicts, they'll tell you after that first high, they're constantly chasing that first high, and it's never as good as their first dose. I'm sure Shannon can speak better to that than I can in working with.
Okay, Shannon.
Again, it is a biopsychosocial phenomena, and the most effective treatments address thinking, feeling, behavior, and the physical components.
As long as we can save their life, right? I mean, we started off
right.
This whole thing talking about overdoses, which are deadly. So Mark, how serious should we be taking this? In other words, is the medical community and the political community that makes policy and determines where money goes, are they taking it as seriously as warranted?
Yeah, well, they're taking it seriously, but they're making a lot of really bad decisions. I mean, the policy of going after this person or that person, the doctors or the dealers, it's just not going to work. You go after one dealer, another one's going to pop up, or 10 more are going to pop up. The idea of restricting the availability of opioid drugs for people who are addicted is just dead wrong, because if you restrict their availability, they will definitely go to the street to get their to get what they need, and they have a much greater likelihood of overdosing. So we need to supply drugs like naloxone, which act directly against the effect of the opioid on breathing, on everything else. So that should be available just about everywhere. That's the only way to stop an OD as it's happening. And we should be making methadone and suboxone available. Those are opioids that are given to people with known addictions who need to take opioids for one reason or another. And restricting those drugs is just going to push them closer to the grave.
That was writer and neuroscientist Mark Lewis. Also joining us, Shannon Gordon, CEO of River Edge Behavioral Health Center, and Chris Hendry, Chief Medical Officer at Navicent Health. And that's today's show, but we would love to hear from you. Should addiction be classified as a disease, or do you believe it's something you can control? Reach us on Facebook or tweet us at OST Talk, and you can always just leave us a message. Our number is 404-500-9457. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.